So, all you soda wanters, relax with faith. What they call the fetters, the first three fetters, they have the ten, what they call the ten fetters, and as the these ten fetters are resolved, then the arahant is one who doesn't have any more fetters. And so these, the first three, I've mentioned them before, the is doubt, vicikicca, personality view, and silabhata paramartha, clinging to conventions, rites, rituals, as a means for purification or enlightenment, as like superstition. And so these are doubt is the is probably one of the greatest problems you'll have, uncertainty and doubt. And I've said before that the approach to it isn't through answering, trying to solve the questions or the doubts in your mind, but actually recognizing the experience itself. You can ask questions, that's fair enough, but I mean the doubt is a habit, and so it's insidious, and it sounds intelligent. So we easily let ourselves doubt and don't take the opportunities to observe doubt as doubt. Not knowing, and there's this Korean master that's quite famous, and he calls it the don't know mind. I like that, don't know. He has an ashram in America, I think, don't know mind. And they deliberately cultivate the don't know mind. And so I rather like that, because we're always trying to know, and we feel, you know, there's this desire to know everything, to have all our doubts, all our problems solved, the doubts to go away, and we know definitely, we're certain, this is it. So practice don't know, like what, when you don't know what it is. A sense of not knowing as experience in the present. And this is where you notice the when you don't know something, your mind will, thinking mind stops. Don't know. Who created the universe? Don't know. So that is a way to contemplate this stopping, this non-plussing of the thinking mind, and you're aware of it. You're doing it quite intentionally. It's not just through the wandering habits and that you have, and you're actually deliberately stopping the thinking mind. and you're aware of its cessation, thought, thinking, there's no thought, no thought is like this. It's humbling too, the idea of monastic life, the alms mendicant, the Buddhist bhikkhu or bhikkhuni, the idea of the one who's satisfied with, who's content with little, who finds contentment and gratitude with the food you get in the alms bowl, the robes you're wearing, the shelter for the night, the medicine that's made available, whatever it might be. And then the basis for medicine that we refer to is fermented urine. That'd be very difficult, wouldn't it, to be content with fermented urine. It probably could become a fashion in this age, but it obviously was a way, in the time of the Buddha, it is medicine. They still use it in Thailand, monasteries. So my preceptor offered me some of his fermented urine when I. It won't kill you. Even though you'd probably rather die than. But this is like the content with rag robes, like the basis for the robe was based on rags, the stuff that the lay people throw out, they don't want anymore. Or the cloth you find corpses wrapped in charnel grounds in India, that cloth nobody wants. And in the time of the Buddha, cloth was probably very difficult to get because it was all hand woven. It wasn't, manufactured like we have. But the idea was the bhikkhus could go and collect rags and make their robes. So the robes are made in patches. So in that sense of a patched rag robe, and then gradually lay people would offer nice textiles, and we get very nice textiles. I've never had to go out and scrounge for rags, 32 years. But the reflection is on that, so that you're developing a contentment with what you have. If I'm in for high quality, then I think I want a pure cotton robe material for my robe, or silk, and then somebody gives me polyester, and then I think, I don't like that. I don't want that. I want silk and a cotton and I don't want those plastic materials, and you get really, really into being one of these purists, that have to have the very best in order to feel all right about yourself. But in alms mendicant is where we want to see that, this discontentment and this fussiness of our minds. So we reflect on the act of giving is the main thing, rather than the quality of the thing given. So if you reflect on somebody gives me polyester or nylon robe and I think, well, it's better than rags. Still better than going out and collecting rags. So you feel gratitude. This gratitude is important. Contentment with little, gratitude. Gratitude to the Buddha, to the teachers, to people who, and this kind of thing is developing a mind that is very that is humble and isn't demanding and isn't complaining and isn't always, you know, trying to improve things and get something better. So this state of mind of humility and contentment, gratitude is also highly recommended for lay people, because we live in an age where we have so many options and choices, and we can be so fussy about what we have to have, and so the mind is endlessly kind of contemplating options or alternatives or higher qualities or pure substances or this, and so then the age is an information age, so there's all kind of information about how important it is to have pure fabrics or food, organically grown vegetables or brown rice or all these, you know, and things that make us, you know, for our health, so we don't get cancer, so we have, you know, we become obsessed with food, with what we wear, with the things around us. So the mind is continually kind of busy with that. So the alms mendicant life I really appreciate, because for me it's always been a good mirror for my complaining mind, for my fussiness. In the place you're in, to be grateful and content with it rather than always wanting to go someplace else. This is very difficult for people here in England, because they always want to go someplace else. You hear about other places that sound better than where you're at, and this desire arises. And rather than reflecting on it, and observing it, using it, one kind of follows it and justifies it, defends it. So many doubts can arise, because there's so many opinions and views about, well, how to practice. Samatha vipassana, people are endlessly asking, do you do samatha or vipassana? Do you practice samatha? Do you believe in samatha? Or then, you know, that one. Then there's Mahayana and Hinayana. And I used to feel offended when I was referred to as Hinayana, and I rather like it. Why not? If people want to see me as Hinayana, what's wrong with that? That's how they want to look at things, but these categories are very important to people, because they make them important. They aren't watching what they're doing. They're not reflecting on what they're actually thinking, and the doubts and the opinions that they attach to. They're actually forming attachments and opinions to conventions, to views, to ideas, to techniques, biases and prejudices and that, and they're not, and so that because of that, the endless doubts will arise. So to get beyond doubt, isn't it, is not to solve all the problems of the world, make sure that you're in the best place with the best teacher that is absolutely certified, certain that this place is, you know, this is the best, this is where it's at. We're in the cutting edge of meditation. We are the best. And there's no better place than Amaravati in the world. It's the best. And Ajahn Sumedho, you can have complete confidence in him, because he's the best. And then, you know, but then you still find something you don't like about the place. And then you can only believe in the best for a while, then you start seeing, you know, start wondering whether it's really true, and you hear about better things. So the mind is being fed all this, you know, arahants in the Himalayas, and little caves here and there, and little cooties by the seaside, and you can really get your samadhi, where you can really develop your meditation, and on like that, without watching this. Believing it and following it. So how do you expect to develop if that, you know, if you endlessly do that, you know, and you believe it and you aren't willing, you know, this is quite a normal way to think, so nothing wrong in having these thoughts, but in looking at them for what they are, apparent here and now, isn't it? All conditions are impermanent, not self. And then to develop a humility and a patience. This is the kind of mind that really is, you know, open to truth, the patient, humble mind, and awakened mind, and content, and not always, you know, caught in doubts and desires to get something you don't have, or become something that you're not, or just complaining because everything around you isn't exactly what you like. Learning to use a situation for mindfulness. This is the challenge. How to use where you are, the conditions you're with, the people you live with, the things that affect you. How to develop mindfulness and how to feel grateful and appreciate the good things of your life. So, like we noticed, the idea of, remember thinking of the ideal monastery, you know, where you have very dedicated monks who you get along with, and none of them are kind of oddballs that kind of throw you off the track, no, they irritate you very much, and your pals, really, your mates, you can get on, and then you can... in a place that is very quiet and peaceful, and without any traffic noises, airplane noises, where there aren't too many people coming and disrupting you, but where the people that do come bring good food and then go away and leave you alone. And then... on and on like that. And you can think of the ideal monastery. And sometimes those things come together, but still, from my experience, that's seldom been the case. I don't think it's ever been the case in my but how to use the situation that I'm in, this is my conundrum. How to use the people I'm living with, how to develop mindfulness, compassion, and learn from the people the way they are, the ones I'm living with, no matter, you know, what they, you know, how they affect me and how, whether I get along or like them, that is not the issue, but because these things will bring up your vipaka kamma. So this is the use of wisdom, sati, panya, sampatanya, how to use even maybe a miserable situation for wisdom, because you can like being in a prison or having a like Peter over there and Jen who have to use their disability for developing wisdom. Their choices, their options aren't as they don't have very many like we do. But yet, that's not an obstruction to wisdom, is it? It's not a disability. It's not a problem, really, unless you want to make it one. Because certainly, good health sometimes is even more of a problem, isn't it? Being healthy and good looking, and who wants to sit, drinking fermented urine when you're thinking? Why waste your youth? You can become a monk when you get old and ugly. In Thailand, for a man that ordains when he's older, after he's had his family. Because there's a lot of that in Thailand, where older men, their wife dies, their children grow up. And they go off to the monastery and become monk. They're called Luang Tas, and it's kind of a comical name, slightly pejorative. It's respectful and yet at the same time conveys the fact that this bloke here, he's had all his fun. His wife died. Children probably want to get rid of him. So he goes and puts himself into a monastery. No, in learning to use the situation you're in, one reflects on how things affect you. And I found sometimes people that are disruptive and I find weird or strange or difficult, then tendencies wanting to get rid of them. But instead of following that, it's more valuable to observe that, the feeling of aversion or disease about who, about any person or group of people. And so that this is how to use a situation, for developing satipanya rather than just trying to go according to your own particular preferences and ideas and then control and try to create the ideal situation for yourself. Because the world is like this realm we live in isn't meant to please us and follow our desires and make itself into what we want. And we've tried that, isn't it? Modern civilization is very much, the problems we face now, pollution and destruction of the environment are due to our endless manipulations, wanting to make everything kind of perfect for ourselves. So that we have, convenience, luxury, security, all these things. And we don't have to work so hard, and we can get what we want very quickly, and have high quality products, and live a comfortable, secure, pleasant, interesting life. And then you look at, say. If you go to areas where people aren't still, it's like third world areas or tribal areas, people don't have those kind of expectations. They've adapted and wisely, if they follow their original culture, they're quite at tune, quite in harmony with the environment that they're living in. They know how to live within the, and use the situation they're in quite skillfully. So that comes quite naturally into when you're, say, uneducated, primitive human being. But we lose that wisdom, that kind of knowledge, when our lives get very artificial and we get lost in our conventions. We live far from nature. So like this school here, this place here, Amaravati, was called St. Margaret's School, and it was built in 1939. These wooden buildings, built by the Canadian government, and it was to be a camp school. The camp school, like a summer school for children living in the slums of London, and bring them out in the countryside so they could see a cow in a tree. Because they couldn't see those things. They thought milk came in bottles and and what's a tree? But the original idea was the idea of communing with nature, because in cities, isn't it, you oftentimes can live in completely artificial, highly controlled situations, flats and houses and that where the effect of nature, the natural conditions, the weather and so forth, least affect you, and you can have a secure, comfortable environment quite continuously. So contemplating this, we're now, say, in meditation, because of the suffering and the disillusionment with our artificiality and our superficial approach to life, we lose touch with the spiritual, with the natural, and we become obsessed with ourselves. So what I need and have to have, and it becomes a life just based on self-obsession, which is suffering, isn't it? To only think of yourself. And there's longing in us to always think of somebody else first. When we sign of maturity is where you can put somebody else ahead of yourself. Think of them before yourself. That is always a sign of a maturing as a human being, where you're not just thinking of yourself first. But then to know the self, isn't it? We find out, of course, that there isn't any. But before you actually have that insight, you have to realize. You have to look, not just believe. Doesn't make any sense to believe that there's no self. It's just because it's not a belief. It's the anatta is a realization. And so you, through awareness, through reflecting, through observing the way things are, you realizing that the what you think you are is not what you are. So whatever you think you are, that's not what you are. So when I discovered that, and because I used to be very critical of myself, so these critical thoughts about myself would come up, and I said, well, I know that's not me. and so I could, it was some relief to know that all the fears and things that I, and the problems I had as a personality, and I could suddenly realize that's not the way it is. So that the self-doubt, the self-criticism, the self-consciousness, all that began to be seen in terms of just the conditioning of the mind that's empty. It's not real, it's not true. It is what it is in the present, but it's nothing more than that. It's just a condition that arises and ceases. What's left when there's no self then? You know, when there's no self left, your self has died away, what's left? And so then this, you know, so you won't have to practice anymore, I'll tell you. you have to believe me. What's left is, there's a tension, isn't there? There's still the conscious awareness operating like this. And it isn't annihilation. The Buddha made this very clear. His teaching of anatta wasn't nihilism or annihilationism. He said it was not, you know, making some kind of eternal soul, or believing in an eternal self or eternal soul, because that's the opposite, isn't it? Where you conceive you have a soul or a self that carries on, forever, or goes into another life or whatever, or lives forever in eternity. But that's based on the sense of a self that does that. Because oftentimes the word soul is just another, still means something that's mine. But in terms of, say, realization, then soul isn't self. Or what's left when there's no self is, you could call that soul if you want, or spirit, but it is what it is. You don't need to, it's the awareness that and the realizing of the deathless. So the gates of the deathless are open. Now how to use the situation you're in for that realization? Because if you think, I can only realize the deathless when I'm in a certain kind of situation. It's as if, you know, the deathless were something you find in India rather than in England or whatever. You know, these stories about religious seekers is going all over the world, you know, and then finding what they've been looking for in their own back garden, that kind of thing. They find it right inside yourself. And then when I talk like this, then people get, but, well, you know, we have to, you know. You hear this kind of, but, yes, I agree with you, you know, I understand, but, and you know, you hear that tone of voice. So they're not, you know, it's really frustrating for me because you hear it so much, and then you're teaching this direct looking, and then and they say they understand, then immediately they go back to the old doubt and the defensive state. So it's this, you know, in mindfulness, it's not, there's no kind of things that hang around. You're with in the present, you know, and you're trusting in this clarity of the moment, of this watching, and even though the object or the what you're feeling might be all fuzzy or confusing, the clarity is in the knowing it's this way, isn't it? I mean, you might be emotionally confused, uncertain, insecure, frightened, and whatnot, but when you awaken to that state, that's what you trust, that's the light, that's your refuge. Not and so it's the light is you, and that and the condition is then seen. It's still fuzzy, or it still can have that those qualities, but you're looking at it from the position of enlightenment rather than from your conditioned sense of self, of identity with what you're thinking, what you're feeling. So it is a, and this practice really is quite, you know, it's ongoing, because there's you know, on a retreat situation, or sometimes we really feel, you know, quite inspired and committed to practice, and we really, you know, can be very enthusiastic. But then we go through periods, the doldrums and the dreary plateaus of the holy life, you know, that seem to, you know, we lose our that kind of enthusiasm and energy, and everything looks pretty dreary. But that's also to be seen in the light. You know, that dreariness of life, the grayness, the lack of inspiration, the feeling of being fed up. And all the rest is can be, you can turn the light on to that. It's like this. And that's part of the I think in you know, it's where you have the life no longer, you no longer even believe or have any confidence in Buddhism. That also can be seen. Because we're not asking you to, it's not like to, that you have to keep kind of pumping up your faith and your inspiration in Buddhism. But even when you can't stand Buddhism anymore, that's, you can observe that. So whatever you're feeling, the whatever condition you're in, is not the obstruction. It's whether you're willing to mindfully reflect and accept what you are feeling. Having disabilities or diseases, I think these aren't obstructions. You can see in your own life how to, you know, when you leave here and you go back home, how to learn from the situation you're in, the people you live with, the work you have, the kind of profession and the duties and obligations. But it does mean to make a determination and try, at least see what you can do. In say, changing your attitude towards the situation you have to live in, by observing how it affects you, rather than thinking family life is preventing me from realizing the deathless. You start blaming your wife or husband. If I didn't have her or him, I would, you know, I could really get my practice together. But that's another mental state, isn't it? So there's always the immediacy of the practice is uddhupadipanno, right now. So even that awareness the emotion that happens to be present, as soon as you turn the light on it, that's an enlightened moment. you're seeing in the light. You're looking at it like this, thinking, "Oh, my wife is, she's the problem because if I weren't married, then I could really get my practice together. And she just wants me to go out and make lots of money to buy the latest models of everything. So she's my obstruction." If you think that, and you can be aware that's a thought, a feeling. Feels like this. In this retreat, I'm hoping you're getting this sense of being able to feel what it is. What is it like to feel like that? To feel that your wife or husband is an obstruction. What does it feel like? Not saying they are or they aren't, but what does it feel like? So that you're noticing that quality, that condition. It's like this. So, I've developed my, for the past, 14 years, I've lived most of the time here, Amaravati, and been through all kinds of, changes and challenges in such place, because I've never done anything on this scale. To set up a center on this scale and to get the support for it and all that, and to it's something that I'd never done it before, and had to kind of take the risk. So it's been a lot of trial and error, and like many people have been disillusioned in the process, but for me the practice is always using it as practice, so that one is learning and also developing along with the, not just to establish a Buddhist center, retreat center, monastery, and all the rest, but as an end in itself. But this is what seemed to be happening. Well, how to use these events, these conditions, for awareness? And of course, it's been a continuous challenge because some of the most personal and hurtful and threatening emotions have been figured off while I've been living in this place. And so it's a but that trying to keep reminding myself, what does it feel like? And then to content myself try to develop this contentment with the roof over the head for the night. Or with the robe, with the food and so forth, and develop this gratitude. And the people that I'm living with. The monks and the nuns and the lay people that live here with me. The cats are easy. Cats are a lot easier to live with, aren't they, than humans? I remember when Ajahn Chah asked me to be, you know, start teaching and helping to translate for him. It was all the Western people coming and then when we established Wat Nana Chan, I only had eight masters, 8 years. And I remember thinking, but Ajahn Chah, you had 20 years before you established Wat Bapong. You know, so I felt, you know, this kind of resentment. And that then he kept pointing, made me look at what I was thinking, what I was feeling, you know, so that I could, use the situation that I was in and my emotional reactions for developing the path. So that was very helpful too, to be able to see, you know, what I was doing with the conditions that I was living in. And then you meet people who have various ideas about they have to have just the right conditions, perfect conditions. So this man I know, he was once a monk and he was at this monastery that I thought was as near perfect as you could get. It was a forest monastery and it was very remote, had beautiful caves in it, and it was just, you know, I looked at it, when I went for a visit one time, I thought, oh, I'd love to live in this monastery. And so I met him in Bangkok the following year, and I said, how did it go? You know, you staying there, Tum Kham. And he said, oh, I couldn't stand it. Well, what was wrong? He said, well, they gave me a kuti, and I always had to walk in front of another monk's kuti in order to get to the dining hall, and that just ruined my vasa. I mean, now I don't know why that would ruin anybody's vasa, but that was his complaint. His kuti had to cross in front of another monk's kuti. So then he said, but now I'm going to go to this place where I won't have that. I'll have the perfect kuti, and and everything's going to be fine. He had it all set up, the ideal place. And then after the month, I met him in Bangkok and said, how was that? And he said, the place where he had to go collect alms had rabid dogs that chase him. So he kept being bit by dogs. Finally disrobed. Because that's the restless mind, and the contented mind, the grateful mind, the humility, and all this. This is a mind that is receptive and open to truth. And so it's humility means you're willing to put up to be even be grateful for disadvantages or frustrating situations. It's willing to learn from what you don't want and don't like. And also, a lot of times we feel, you know, we've got to become teachers and all this. The way we can make monastic life, you know, here in the West, into a profession, you know, where you have to have all these qualifications. And so people get intimidated. I've heard people say they can't be monks or nuns or monk. These are mainly monks complaining, but they can't learn the chanting, so they can't feel they're really monks because they somehow had memorized the Pali chanting. And they said, it doesn't matter, you know, you can, you can, if you can't, you can't. And they make that into, you know, that this is really important. If you can't memorize Pali and chant, then you're obviously not meant to be a monk. But that's not the point of a monk, is it? You know, it's part of the convention we have, but it's not the reason why, you know, the purpose of monastic life, to be able to chant in Pali. And then, or they, you know, they'll feel, you know, they can't become, they have no ability to teach. And then they feel, you know, they feel inferior to people who are teachers. Or some people are very, you know, clever and charismatic, and others are not. So this brings up this sense of your self-worth. But those are the very states you want to see, you know, to observe, you know, that you feel, you know, that you're not as good, or you can't teach, or you're not as good a teacher, or that you're not charismatic, or whatever, and therefore these kind of things are, you know, important to recognize and turn the light on to these feelings and these attitudes. The purpose is enlightenment, isn't it? The goal is nibbana, not to become a charismatic guru. It's from my experience, because I've been a focus for a lot of attention, and so I've fairly well known, and I realized quite a few years ago the price you have to pay for that. So I've deliberately tried to tone it down, because, you know, that I realize that, like, being famous or well known is not a very nice, you know, it's not a very nice way to have to live. And so, you know, it's such a hassle, because people don't, you know, they see you in a funny way, you know, and then oftentimes, what, you know, it's just very cumbersome and unpleasant to have to deal with that kind of experience, because the life of the alms mendicant is you do like the kind of solitude of it, and being a non-entity, you know, that's what, you know, is what I prefer, is more that than becoming well known, because in terms of day-to-day living, it's much more pleasant to have a quiet life as a non-entity. And the perks of fame and that, you know, it has its good side too. It's not to that it, but it also is very demanding and stressful. But one can use all these things for practice. It's not that, you know, there's like fame is not a problem either. Not an obstruction if you learn how to reflect on it and use it, and not be identified with it. So, whatever things we have to deal with in life are, you know, it's our karma, it's our path. So it's a matter of reflecting on it, using it, rather than believing our emotional habits that might be associated with the experiences and situations. The past few years, some of the Sangha have been, you know, questioned, what's wrong with, what are we doing wrong here that people disrobe and leave and all this? And so then it's assumed that something's wrong, and that isn't questioned, you know, that they don't, these people that do this, they're not looking at that very assumption. Because the, you know, is there, it's not, it's to deny that there, that, you know, not saying everything's right, but we're already very much concerned about what goes wrong with ourselves, with the world. And so we that's immediately the kind of thing that we get into our mind. If something fails or something doesn't work out, somebody just goes, what's wrong? Who's to blame? That kind of thing. So in terms of developing life of a samana is to not make what's wrong with life, with yourself, with others, the important issue, what you consciously hold on to and involve yourself with. And think of what's right. Reflect on the food in the alms bowl. That's right, isn't it? Gratitude, the shelter, and the teaching, and the generosity of the lay people, or the opportunities and the encouragement that we have to develop gratitude and contentment, rather than to be concerned always with what's wrong. That if that we're here in order to kind of please everybody, or we've got to, you know, the idea of we've got to make it European, or we've got to readjust it so that everybody will be pleased with it, or that we'll be meeting the needs of modern people in Western Europe, that kind of thing. And there's no hope in that way of thinking, because these always lead to varying opinions and conflicts. So in terms of what are the blessings of my life? And so I feel that the four requisite blessings are abundant here in Britain. I feel, you know, the Amaravati, the temple, these are like blessings that have come here. The lay people, the lay support, the monks, the nuns, they're blessing me. I think in terms of blessing, of being blessed, rather than in terms of what's wrong. This is how I intentionally try to train myself, because I'm very much aware of what I think is wrong with everybody, and myself included. But I don't believe it. I don't believe it. Then I've had this practice of mudita, rejoicing in the goodness of life, in the goodness of others. So I say, I sympathetically rejoice in the inconceivably vast oceans of good actions performed by a conscious being since beginningless time. I sympathetically rejoice. I really like that word, rejoice. Suddenly, you know, I think about rejoicing. So, you know, this is a lot of my practice in like when I'm sitting up here, you might think I'm, you know, a lot of my practice around rejoicing in your goodness. Rather than thinking in terms of personalities or views and that about, you know, how we affect each other, or that on the personal level. And so I find this, you know, the mind, then I'm using my mind quite intentionally as a way of gladdening the mind, because it's a lovely thing to be able to rejoice in the goodness of others. What goodness? I don't know. Everybody, you know, has it, isn't it? Most of your life is good, isn't it? Most of mine is good. You know, basically a good person. So, I mean, and this is something to rejoice in the goodness of life. Because and this isn't getting attached to, this isn't like forming an attachment to anything, but it's a way of consciously developing an attitude that brings joy into your mind and also improves the way you look at people. When you think of people as good and you rejoice in their goodness, it changes how I see you. If I see you, you know, some bias or some opinion that I'm projecting, some memory of the past, I can get you all wrong. I can just, you know, think, well, you know, he's like that. You know, last week he said something to me that really, you know, offended me. So I see you through what I remember, what you said to me last week. You're not that way now. That was last week, and that's the memory. So the rejoicing in the goodness of the present. So this is say the development of mudita, and it's something that I feel very a strong affinity to these days, because I've never been able to do it before. I've been too critical of everyone. But now I can. It's a lovely way to live, isn't it? With say, with the practice. When I was in India for last month, so much of that time was spent in this rejoicing, in the gratitude and contentment of the good things around me, of the people, of the situation I was in. And this, of course, uplifts the heart. It gives, that makes one's life into the experience of, that is very beautiful, you know, on the personal level, but also we can see that it does affect others, that we do, when we feel this love and joy and rejoice in each other's goodness, and then there's a different world we're living in than the world that is full of problems, issues, resentments, endlessly, you know, going over what's wrong and exaggerating the things that we don't like in ourselves or each other or the society. And it's a world now that's filled with gloom, doom, and with, you know, as we're trying to, you know, having all these trials and exposés of sleaze and corruption and Clinton's sex life and what's wrong with Robin Cook and what's wrong with you know, the Sani Abacha in Nigeria and Saddam Hussein and the Indians, you know, India's detonated atomic bombs and now the whole world is kind of condemning India go on and on, you know, in this way. We're so used to this kind of behavior, but it is depressing. And bring in the next millennium, you know, with the gloom doom state of mind? Do we have to, or is there another way? I'm not talking about, you know, naivety or think pink, but learning, really understanding your, how your mind works, that we, this mind, human mind can generate. It is filled with love, and love will flow from it if you free it from these delusions. Joy in that then come through these forms, these human forms. So I offer this as a reflection.